Hello and welcome to Watch the Media. I'm John Schrader. This is a men's World Cup year. The world fascinated by this beautiful game, soccer, or as they call it, most of the rest of the world, football. Americans are more and more fascinated by the game.
The ball over the top, and Mukhtar's been played onside by Tinahol. Hani Mukhtar for Nashville. He beats Johnson this time, and the boys in gold go in front.
It's been fascinating to see just the appetite that American sports fans have for the game now. I think it was always there, but I think so many more people are able to be exposed to the game now and really, you know, take a liking to it.
That's Jeff Carlisle. He's covered soccer for more than 20 years, 17 of them at ESPN. He's seen this game grow. He's seen MLS explode, and the World Cup comes here in 6 years.
And I think that's the real opportunity, you know, in the run-up to this World Cup in 2026. I think that's really, you know, to make it a game for everyone, and not just in words, but in deeds.
Acosta drives it in. McKennie got to it. There's the early goal.
A goal early in the game and a goal off a set piece. And it is Weston McKennie who gets on the end of the ball. Kellen Acosta, the number one job from a set piece, give your players, attacking players, an opportunity. And boy, does he. Beats the first man. McKennie rises up.
We're talking about the world's game, how it's covered here in the U.S., and a whole lot more this time around on Watch the Media. We are now joined by a gentleman who knows just about everything about soccer in America and beyond. He's been covering soccer for more than 20 years and for the last 17 years at ESPN. Jeff Carlisle, thanks a million for your time.
Yeah, no problem, John. Great to reconnect.
Now, we know each other from way back in the good old days before Major League Soccer, before this thing exploded, and Bay Area guys. And so I've sort of watched you grow into this role, and it's been a kind of a pretty cool development in your career, hasn't it? When you've been able to really focus on one thing, although soccer isn't one thing, you've been able to focus in that area.
Yeah, I mean it's a long way from my high tech days. I was actually a software engineer for 12 years, and you know, worked for a big company, worked for a startup, and then it was end of '99 that I started to make the transition, into journalism. I mean, it was kind of coaching and journalism. I was doing some youth coaching, some college assistant coaching, and then writing as well. And the writing is the one that kind of took off a little bit more. So, started writing for QuakeMagic.com. That was the first outlet that I ever wrote for. It was kind of a local Bay Area outlet. And then, just everything. It's been kind of a crazy journey, but yeah, it's been fun though.
So anybody who's listening to this right now is saying, Schrader, ask him the question, why would you leave a high tech job in the middle of Silicon Valley where it happens? And I'm sure in the beginning, you didn't make a whole lot of money at Quake's Magic. Why did you do that?
You know, I just, after 12 years, you know, I kind of just lost my passion for that line of work, for that industry. And, you know, I just decided that I wanted to do something else with my life. And I played collegiately at Northwestern. And so, I started getting into coaching, and I really decided that I wanted to tap in to what I was passionate about, which was soccer. And so, a guy that I met through coaching, a guy by the name of Nick Arellano, who lives in the Bay Area, you know, he was the guy that ran Quake Magic. And I asked him, hey, you know, do you want any writers or do you need any writers? And he said, yeah. And I said, you know, I've never done this before. And he goes, I don't care. So, you know, I think there was a lot, there was an immense hunger at the time for soccer news of any kind. And, you know, a lot of the daily newspapers weren't really covering it on in an intense way and in a real, you know, super dedicated way. And so, and I think there was room for, hey, here's what happened at practice today, or here's the player that I talked to, or here's what, you know, at the time Frank Yallop said about the season. And so, I really was able to kind of just slide into that. And again, I was super passionate about it. And, you know, one thing kind of led to another. I did some freelancing, I wrote for some magazines, and then it was around 2005 that I started writing for ESPN. And again, that was kind of crumbs in the beginning. It was like a piece a month. And, but, you know, every journalist kind of, they need their rabbi. They need that guy that's going to believe in them and appreciates their work and what they do. And for me, that was a guy by the name of Jen Chang at ESPN at the time. And so he took a liking to my work and gave me a broader platform. So I was the beneficiary of really good timing and some people that really believed in my work. So that was super helpful along the way.
So Jeff, Northwestern's very proud, and anybody who's got a journalism degree from Northwestern will tell the whole world that they went to school at Northwestern and have a journalism degree. We know many of them, but you're a software engineering. You're a software engineering guy who ended up in journalism. Where'd you get the journalism training? Where'd you learn how to be a journalist?
It was a lot of, you know, learning by doing. I mean, you know, those first few years I was writing for Quake Magic, there was a guy on the Quakes beat named Dylan Hernandez, who's now a big time columnist for the LA Times and does a great job. And so I watched people like him, a guy by the name of Dwight Chapin at the time, who had also covered some, you know, he covered the Lakers in the Kareem era. I mean, he covered some big time teams. And then Elliot Allman was another one who from the San Jose Mercury News, you know, along with Dylan at the time. And so I just watched how they did their work, and I watched how they conducted themselves. And, you know, I just tried to be a sponge as much as I could. And again, watch those guys. And you know, you're going to make mistakes. I mean, you know, you're going to think, oh man, that sentence didn't work, or, you know, gee, I got that, you know, occasionally you get things wrong. I mean, you don't mean to, but sometimes that happens too. And so, you know, you kind of take those lumps and say, okay, you know, what did I learn from this? You know, what should I have done? You know, how could I have done this better? And so, but those three individuals that I named are such good people, nice people, willing to help out, willing to give you feedback. And, you know, Ann Killian was another one. I mean, she was a columnist at the Merc at the time, but, you know, she would, you know, occasionally, you know, pop up on the Quakes beat. And so she was another one that I watched and, you know, tried to really, yeah, again, just absorb the good things that they were doing. And there were a lot of them. And so, again, you just kind of learn by doing, and you learn by watching too.
Yeah, really good advice for young people trained as journalists in college or not. Pay attention to what people do. Learn from what they do. Learn from your own mistakes. Ask questions. Be humble. Be humbled, right, by what you write. And when you do that, Jeff, right, the Dwight Chapins, who had been around forever before he started covering soccer, and Ann Killian, they like to help you if you say, yeah, help. I need some help. And what should I do better next time? Really, they want to help you, yeah, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, Dylan in particular was just fantastic. You know, he gave me a lot of feedback early on, and it gives you a lot of confidence when, you know, other people are reading your stuff and, you know, they're complimentary towards what you do. And, again, I watched him a lot, and again, really just tried to take everything in.
So I'm going to make this almost a multi-part question here, but they're all sort of in the same vein. In the last, Major League Soccer was founded in 1996. Before that, it was the World Cup that was played here in 94. We have another one coming up here in 2026. But over those 20 plus years you've been doing this, how much has the soccer business changed, and with it, the interest of the consumer and how the media have approached the business in those 20 plus years? So sort of separate questions, but all sort of in the same vein. And that is, soccer has really changed a lot in the last 22 years.
Yeah, it's changed a ton. I mean, I think the coverage is broader. The level of coverage that Fox and ESPN and, you know, and other outlets that are starting to come on board, you know, The Athletic, obviously taking a huge interest in the sport. All of that helps. I guess in terms of changes that, you know, I thought it was pretty fast before, and then social media happened. And, you know, it's, you're on call 24/7, and it's really hard to unplug these days, but things just happen so fast. And, you know, you learn that, okay, I know this piece of information that fans would be interested in. You know, is it a written piece? Is it a tweet? Is it, you know, all of the above? And so you just got to be more and more nimble, I think, as time goes on. And it's been fascinating to see just the appetite that American sports fans have for the game now. I think it was always there. But I think so many more people are able to be exposed to the game now and really, you know, take a liking to it. I mean, having played the game in college, I mean, it was almost like, it was what my father-in-law calls the any use rule. If you were any use, you would not be playing soccer. You know, you would be playing one of the bigger sports. And this is a guy, believe me, who loves soccer, loves Gaelic football, you know, all that stuff. And so, it was not cool to be a soccer player or a soccer fan back in the 90s. I think the World Cup really pushed things to start changing. But I think, you know, even now you still see some derogatory remarks. And there were some columnists who I will not name who seemed to get, you know, every year they would trot out, you know, soccer's boring, it's never going to amount to anything. And now you don't even have that discussion anymore. I mean, it's the game is here to stay. It's not going to crumble or die because one bad thing happens, or, like, you know, the national team missing a World Cup. I mean, the game is going to survive. The roots run much deeper now. And that's a great thing. That's something I'm happy to have seen.
Jeff Carlisle covers soccer for ESPN. I'm John Schrader. So give us an idea of what you do. What do you do? Describe for us your job, please.
Oh, wow. It's a lot of things. It's about writing features. It's about writing analysis, you know, of teams, of players, of games. It's breaking news. I mean, that seems to be what drives a lot of traffic these days. And like it or not, you know, traffic is an important metric in terms of covering the sport and people continuing to, you know, media companies continuing to invest in the sport. So it's, you know, it's hard to get your arms around it sometimes, you know, when your remit is that broad. There are soccer journalists out there. All they do is transfer stuff. They don't, the Fabrizio Romanos or even, Tom Bogert for MLSsoccer.com. I mean, those guys are, you know, primarily focused on breaking news, and you could, that could soak up all of your day, if you let it. But you know, for national writers, you know, it's the responsibilities are broader, and you've got to try to spot trends and write about those and write, you know, even compelling human interest stuff. And so, you know, it can be a little, you know, I find it a little daunting sometimes. You know, it's like, what do I focus on? Do I focus on this? Do I focus on that? And so it can be tough, but you know, the payoff is when, you know, you've done something well, whether it was, you know, breaking a story or you're writing a feature that speaks to people. You know, that's the payoff. That's where you, you know, you kind of turn off the computer at the end of the day and say, okay, we did good.
So you primarily focus on Major League Soccer and the major national teams, the men and the women, or do you go beyond that?
Yeah, I'd say that's, you know, mostly my focus. You know, I think the women's game deserves beat writers in their own right. And so, you know, fortunately at ESPN, we've hired someone named Caitlin Murray, who has written a book about the women's national team and knows the women's game inside and out. And that's been a huge help. You know, I've been to two Women's World Cups. You know, I was at the final in 2015. And, you know, obviously the game has gone through big ups and some big downs. But it's great to have, but I think it deserves to have singular coverage. And so, you know, that's why, for one, I'm grateful that Caitlin is on board with us now, because she just brings so much knowledge and a really good eye and ear for things. And so, so yeah, but that's, you're right. That's kind of my remit. I would say mostly MLS men's national team. I'd say that's my primary focus.
This ball and flicked along by Pepe Zimmerman and Pulisic! Christian Pulisic, 3-0!
This is a big moment for Christian Pulisic and this team. And another ball on a set piece. Pepe does well to get across at the near post. That keeps the ball alive.
We're recording this conversation not long after the United States of America and Honduras played in minus 12 degree wind chills in St. Paul, Minnesota. Tell me what that experience was like, and please tell me that was a bad idea, because I watched on television and I thought it was a really bad idea.
Yeah, I mean, from the moment that it was announced, I remember thinking, why are they doing this? Because it just seemed so unnecessary. I mean, 4 years ago, the U.S. beat Honduras 6-0 in San Jose, California. And so it helps to understand a little bit Greg Berhalter's mindset. He's very much into maximizing everything, every advantage that he has. And so when Canada, and one thing he hates more than anything is travel time, whether it's travel from the hotel to the practice field, travel from, you know, on planes, it's just a thing with him. And so once Canada moved the game, you know, it was supposed to be in Vancouver, then it was, you know, they decided they wanted to play it in Hamilton, Ontario. That really influenced the USSF's thinking. And so, you know, I think some options were off the table, but I mean, I think they could have found a way to do this anywhere else. I think they got lucky in Columbus. It wasn't that cold. Obviously Hamilton, they had no control over that, but I mean, I was lucky. I was in an indoor press box. I had a colleague of mine, and I posted a photo of him on Twitter where he was bundled up. I mean, there was not a single bit of exposed skin. He had goggles on. I mean, it was just that cold. And we were standing there at practice the day before, and that was only 18 degrees. And it was cold. I mean, granted, I lived in Chicago for 9 years, but in the 30 years that I've lived in California, I've definitely gotten soft. But it was, even then, it was uncomfortable. And then even the walk to the car after the game, I mean, it's minus two, and I can't imagine playing in those conditions. And, you know, when I played in college, I mean, listen, 35 degrees and drizzle is its own special kind of discomfort, but this was next level. And I can't believe that the U.S. will ever do this again. I mean, first of all, COVID has forced these games to be scheduled when they are. That's part of it. But, you know, it's going to be another 8 years before the U.S. hosts another World Cup qualifier, because obviously they're hosting in 2026. So it's going to be a while before we ever see something like that again. Hopefully never, because, you know, as much as the USSF tried to put a positive spin on it, this was ridiculous. And they really should not have gone this route. But what's done is done. They got the result they needed. Padded their goal differential a little bit, and now they go on to the final fixture window, still with a lot of work to do, but I think they're feeling a bit better about themselves than they were after the Canada game, for sure.
Can you imagine, Jeff, 20 years ago, maybe even less time than that, that the kind of interest in American soccer, something that happens around American soccer, would have gotten this kind of reaction 25 years ago, even at the beginning of Major League Soccer, if the U.S. Soccer Federation had done something like this, there would have been a lot of ho-hum around the country. But there were an awful lot of people who had something to say about this, which has something to say about how many people care about soccer, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it is amazing how much the game has grown. I remember, I was home for the holidays, and it was in the mid-90s, and I grew up in South Florida and was a huge Dolphins fan. And I remember I went to a game while I was back home, and I remember looking around the stadium, and I remember thinking, man, what if I was watching Landon Donovan on the field, you know, in front of this kind of crowd? I mean, wouldn't that be amazing? And now it's not a fantasy at all. I mean, it's a reality in a lot of these stadiums. I mean, you look at places like Seattle and Portland and Atlanta, and it's just incredible the level of crowd support they have and the level of interest they have, and the national teams as well. I think every team, you know, every franchise has contributed to the ecosystem and helped really grow this game. To me, that was like the biggest, that was the killer, not a killer blow, but it was a massive blow in the U.S. not qualifying for the 2018 World Cup. Was, you know, because I've watched every single World Cup, every time that rolled around, the interest level would bump up. You'd see it in the ratings, you'd see it, you know, eventually on social media. And so that, you know, that did a lot of damage. And in some respects, that's not going to be healed, I think, until, you know, the men qualify again. Obviously, the women can always be counted on to make the World Cup, and the calculus of how they get attention is different. But it all helps. It all helps advance the game and expose the game to more and more people. So, you know, we'll see if the U.S. men can get it done this time.
Just for the record, while the U.S. is in pretty good shape, they trail Canada. They're even with Mexico and have three contenders left to play, Mexico, Panama, and Costa Rica. And two of those matches are on the road. But this is a better group of talent, do you think, Jeff? We're chatting with Jeff Carlisle, who covers soccer for ESPN. Is this the best group of young talent, he says he thinks, sure, that the American team has ever had?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at the clubs where a lot of these guys are playing, and it's amazing. I mean, you know, you've got guys at Chelsea and Juventus, and you've got a guy playing for in Tim Weah playing for the reigning French champions. You've got guys in Germany. I mean, Gio Reyna, I mean, playing for a big club in Dortmund. And so, yes, I would say it's the most talented. But I think part of the reason why the U.S. didn't qualify last time is there was this gap. There was this generation of players that never quite rose to the level that was expected of them. Not only did they not do it with clubs, but they didn't do it with the national team either. And so I think the last cycle, you had a situation where the U.S. was kind of caught between generations. You know, you had this older veteran generation that the younger guys didn't do anything to supplant. And so, and I think there have been times this cycle where that lack of experience, that lack of kind of passing the baton from one generation to another has hurt them. I mean, I think this team has left points on the table in places like El Salvador, like Jamaica, where, you know, especially the Jamaica game where they were ahead. I mean, they couldn't, you know, they couldn't figure out a way to really close that one out. And you hope that won't come back to bite them, but that's always nagged at me throughout this whole cycle. So yes, I agree that they're the most talented, but that they still need to accumulate some experience. And then I think they'll be hitting their stride. You know, you hope that they're able to close the deal and qualify and then gain additional experience at a World Cup so that they're really flying by the time 2026 comes around. Because that is a huge opportunity for the sport in this country. I mean, just, you know, obviously hosting it with Mexico and Canada, there's just going to be a ton of eyeballs on the game in a way that hasn't been seen, you know, since 94. And so, and there's just so much more momentum around the game right now as well. So that's a huge opportunity. And again, we'll see if the country can and the soccer infrastructure and ecosystem can take advantage.
I'm going to preface this question with this. We have surveys that say that young people, say 18 to 25 in this country, are almost as likely to watch a European soccer match on television as they are to watch Major League Baseball. Right. And I don't think that surprises you, and it doesn't surprise me. I'm around young people all the time, and they think baseball is long and boring and there aren't enough young stars, although there are some developing young stars. But the question is, if we can, what's the profile of the American soccer fan? Who are you writing for, and who is the American soccer fan?
Wow, who is the American soccer fan? I think I mean, if you can put that into one bucket, I think it does tend to trend younger. I think it does, you know, it has been a suburban sport for a long time. And so I think a lot more can be done to really, you know, tap into minority communities. I mean, obviously the Latino community has always supported the game and always followed it. But in terms of, you know, I would say not enough has been done over the years to really kind of bring them in and make them feel part of the family. And so, you know, I think that's a huge opportunity. So I think there are a ton of Latino fans. I think, you know, getting them to become fans of a Major League Soccer team or the U.S. national teams, I think is still, I still think that's a huge challenge. And, you know, it's tough because I think, you know, we are a nation of immigrants. And so there is that pull to still support, you know, teams from the old country. And it's a shame in the way that it's been kind of framed as an either or, like you can't enjoy both. And I think we see that in a lot of the conversations surrounding dual nationals and who they ultimately decide to play for, because it's, you know, you're asking them to be torn in two. Emotionally, because it's, you know, they have to pick one or the other, and they're gonna, you know, tick off one country's fans and be embraced by the other. And so that's a tough thing. So, you know, it's, you know, when I think about the typical American fan, I think it's a fairly big tent, but it could be bigger, and it needs to be bigger. And you know, we'll see the extent. And I think that's the real opportunity, you know, in the run-up to this World Cup in 2026. I think that's really, you know, to make it a game for everyone, and not just in words, but in deeds. And listen, there are a lot of you know, good people out there trying to do that. I mean, Ed Foster Simeon with the U.S. Soccer Foundation, not to be confused with the Federation, just the many pitches that they're building around the country and trying to increase access to the game. That's a huge opportunity, is access. And it's one that the sport hasn't always done a good job with in the past, but it, you know, they can still try to do more. They can still try to make that tent bigger. So I think you started out like, what is the American fan? It's so many things. But I mean, the participation rates are starting to decline. I mean, granted, some of that's COVID induced, but you know, I think, you know, there's some growing pains for sure within the sport. And yeah, I think it does tend to be whiter, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, but I think so much can be done. I mean, and you see places like LA and you see, you know, Latino supporters groups of MLS teams, you're starting to see more of that. But I remember I was in Nashville before their first game in 2020 and talking to some of it was called the Golden Brigade. I mean, I can't remember, you know, what it was in Spanish, but you know, they felt like that the club had not done enough to really reach out to them. They felt like other supporters groups had, but the club itself. So again, I think there's such an opportunity not to convince them about the game. I think that's already been done, but to kind of convince them that, you know, yeah, you can support Club America, but you can also support Nashville SC and really just try to increase that level of engagement and the national teams as well. You know, I think, you know, just in terms of embracing, you know, Latino and you know, immigrant fans, I mean, I think that's supporters culture has been important in that. And I think you look at, you know, some of the steps and the issues that have been focused on in places like Portland and Seattle and even in New York City, you know, with you know, some of the issues that you know, they've had with some of their fans. And you know, I think that's kind of kept MLS more honest in a lot of ways in terms of how they market themselves and how, you know, and in terms of addressing these things. I mean, when I think of the Timbers Army, you know, they really kind of held MLS's feet to the fire in terms of in Seattle too, in terms of, you know, the Iron Front, you know, whether that was a political symbol or not, and flying that flag. And so, you know, you were talking earlier about kind of the, like, how would I describe the American fan? I mean, I think it is a little bit more of a progressive, I mean, there is a little bit more of a progressive bent than I think in other sports. And I think that's reflected in some of the issues that have been taken up by supporters groups, by the Independent Supporters Council and organizations like that. And so I think that's been healthy for the game, necessary for the game over the years.
And I think, Jeff, that's been healthy for American sports, for right. The American conversation, right? We're not talking about decisions that by like NFL players kneeling, you know, they sort of brushed it aside and then it came back. Now these kinds of conversations come to the forefront because their fans are demanding it.
Right, exactly. And so, yeah, and I think that can only benefit the game going forward. Because again, when you're trying to build the sport in a way that, begins to approach, you know, the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, even hockey, you need to have as big a tent as possible. You need to be super welcoming. And I think supporters groups in general do a good job of that. And I think MLS has been, and the sport in general, have been the beneficiaries.
One final thought here, and sometimes I sort of imagine this. I imagine if I was a baseball reporter in the 20s, 30s, 40s, when Major League Baseball is emerging into a national product, and maybe it already had by then, and the National Football League in the late 50s and into the 60s. And here you are among a sort of pioneering group of media, pioneering group of reporters who have watched and chronicled the emergence of soccer into a national entity from the 90s into the 21st century. You think about that? Have you thought about that? Is that a notion that is fair? And if so, how do you kind of put that into context for yourself and maybe for the rest of us?
You know, in terms of feeling like a pioneer or...
a pioneer and ability to watch the game and chronicle the game as it grows. Look at, I mean, I started Major League Soccer announcing it in 1996. Holy cow. You wouldn't even imagine what soccer looked like in 1996 if you just turned on a game today or if you just went to a game today. You couldn't imagine it was the same game. It was the same entity. You feel like you're there at the moment when this egg is being cracked open and it's exciting to watch it develop into something.
Yeah. I mean, it is exciting and, you know, you do feel, I don't know if I necessarily feel like a pioneer. I mean, as I've kind of gone through it, I haven't really thought about it in those terms. I mean, I think I've just tended to focus on what I'm doing. I mean, fortunately ESPN has been a pretty big backer of the game, you know, for a while now. And so, there isn't, you don't have to evangelize quite as much, but you could always do more, but it is fascinating. I mean, going back to that story I had about, watching the Dolphins play and thinking, man, when can it get to this point? It is, I forget exactly when it was, but it was, maybe it was when I went to MLS Cup in Atlanta, and just the size of the crowd and the intensity of the support, it was like, wow, we're here. We have, when I say we, I'm talking about like just the sport. This is incredible. I still think there's a ways to go. I mean, when you look at, the NFL, the NBA, I mean, even baseball still, I mean, it's, their reach is still in this country is still incredible. I do think another challenge is, you've got fans of the game who will only consume the Premier League or will only consume Liga MX. And so I think there's still a challenge there to try to convince them to become fans of MLS and the NWSL and, the national teams. I mean, that challenge is still there. But it has been kind of cool to kind of see this thing grow. And it hasn't been linear. I mean, you still see some things, just not to like beat this dead horse, but I mean, some of the roster rules are just, so in MLS are so arcane and just, I think sometimes that makes it kind of difficult for fans to really, and that's, to really get into it. And that's not to say that other sports, like the NFL and the NBA don't have complex rules either. But when you're trying to play catch up, I think you want to make it easier, not harder.
Yeah.
And so, I think, like I said, there's still room for improvement, but, it has been amazing to see. I mean, for the longest time, MLS used to say, hey, this is historic, and it's kind of like, okay, come on, this is really, it's, maybe another milestone, but like not that big a deal. But I think, just brick by brick, and that's where I give MLS a lot of credit. Brick by brick, they just slowly built this league and made good decisions in terms of expansion markets and grown the business. And I think that's so important. This enterprise, this sport, it has to be treated like a business in some degree, because otherwise it won't grow. I mean, granted, there's grassroots stuff that's important. There's you know, there's other aspects to it that are important. But, you know, I look at the struggles of the women's game, and I think now more than ever, the NWSL is being treated like a business rather than some kind of charity or social cause. I mean, I think that's been true of the whole sport at times. And I think it's gradually going away, but I think, just my opinion, I think the women's game has kind of struggled with that a little bit more than the men's side. And so, and part of it, I think, is historical, just because women's leagues have not, you know, I think the NWSL is here to stay, but prior to that, women's leagues really kind of, you never knew from year to year if they were going to survive. And so, and I think part of that was down to not treating it like a business with expected returns. So it's, it's still a money losing venture for a lot of people, but I just think the quality of investor, quality of owner has increased quite a bit.
Yeah.
And so, but again, we'll see how it goes.
And you came along at a time, and a lot of younger people may not know this, but you came along at a time, 99, 2000, when this league, Major League Soccer, could have just as easily folded as it would to continue. I mean, one guy owned half the teams in the league at one point, yeah. Philip Anschutz. And so it has been almost a miracle that it has expanded so much, so many billionaires investing in it, so many stadia being built around the country. In the early days, in those early years, that wasn't such a certainty. But I agree, they've made a lot of good decisions, rules, arcane rules notwithstanding. They have made a lot of good decisions in the last 15 years or so that have been pretty solid. So. Hey, Jeff, thanks. I appreciate it very much. I could talk soccer all day long and about how it's covered and why you do it. And so I appreciate the time.
Yeah, anytime. Really
great
appreciate
to see
it.
You. Great to see Likewise. You. I've known Jeff for a long time. Attaboy, great work. Good job. And enjoy your travels around the world in the next 12 months.
Will do.
All right. Jeff Carlisle covers soccer for ESPN. I'm John Schrader.